I guess since I was going to talk about two topics, but really the first thing is really just I was making these comments about Burkhoff's talk, who isn't here anyway. He's teaching, okay. So basically, the topological metal story is kind of quite interesting. And we have these wild points, but these formulas for the anomalous for the wild semi-metals are very actually direct specializations of the anomalous Hall formulas I produced a few years ago in 2004. And actually, the issue of the surface states, the Fermi arcs connecting the surface states, solves one issue that I hadn't realized back in 2004, exactly how the connection between topologically connected but spatially or reciprocal spatially disjoint Fermi surfaces occurs. So our basic thing, if we have this kind of topological metal with the Fermi, have I got my fingers? Yeah, with a Fermi point here, a wild point here, and a Fermi surface surrounding it, we have these two bits of Fermi surface which have Chern numbers individually, plus and minus Chern, one Chern numbers. And of course, there's the old form of the intrinsic Hall effect formula initially is the one where you get an integral over all the occupied states from the bottom of the bands up to the Fermi level. And it's an integral of the Fermi, of the Berry curvature weighted by the occupation factors. But the general principle is that the transport properties occur at the Fermi level, and I guess I'm talking only about whatever Burkhoff was calling sigma 2, the Schrader formula term. And the basic point is that this can be transformed into a formula which involves only the Fermi surface. Basically, by integrating upwards, it's a surface term, and we get an interesting term which tells you that the Hall conductance in three dimensions, which is dimensionally e squared over h times a wave vector, that wave vector is a reciprocal vector which is not determined, a topological part which is a reciprocal vector plus a geometric part which is determined at the Fermi surface. And these integrals of the Berry curvature is basically the dipole moment of the Berry curvature in K space on the Fermi surface is ambiguous modulo a reciprocal vector. So we can only determine that reciprocal vector by inspecting the edges of the sample. And one basic point about this formula is that it has to be gauge invariant under a shift of the Fermi vector because the block vectors of charged particles are not gauge dependent. You can add an arbitrary constant gauge term to it, which is consistent with Bloch theorem. And so this formula, the gauge invariance, for example, that if I add a constant to Kf, tells you that the sum of the Chern numbers over all the Fermi surfaces add to va has to zero has to vanish, and that's a gauge condition that the total Chern number in the Fermi surface has to vanish if it's not some funny state that's embedded in higher dimensions. And actually, that principle of shifting the Fermi surface around can actually extends to defining a separate gauge invariance associated with almost each distinct part block piece of the Fermi surface. And for a topologically trivial part of the Fermi surface with no Chern number on it, basically this formula is there's a kind of dipole moment, which is this is the part of the Berry curvature on the right and the left, and there's another part in this formula that tells you if I've got an arbitrary choice on how to draw my Fermi, my Brillouin zone. It's a completely arbitrary choice, and of course, a natural way to draw it for this thing is to draw it so the Fermi surface blob is completely inside the Brillouin zone. But if I make a different choice of Brillouin zone like this, I get an extra piece, and that's this term over here, which tells you about the wave vector, the reciprocal vector that you jump when you reduce back into the reduced Brillouin zone when you cross the boundary enters here. So this part of the formula guarantees that it's invariant under arbitrary choices of Brillouin zone. And so you can actually, the gauge invariant, this is gauge invariant because I could kind of move this blob of the Fermi surface with Chern number zero around, and it doesn't, there's no net Chern number, so there's no problem with that term. But if I have a topological metal where I have different parts of the different charged or very charged Fermi surface sectors, I have an ambiguity of a reciprocal vector depending on how I draw the Fermi surface box around it. So if I have to calculate the dipole moment within the Brillouin zone, this choice and that choice differ by moving this point by one reciprocal vector, and that moves the Berry charge and adds a kind of changes the dipole moment. So there's actually, once you've got these topologically non-trivial surfaces around wild points or whatever, then you actually have some additional ambiguity, and it shows you that I can't move one of these blobs by themselves. I can only move the two together. So there's no separate gauge invariance for this and this. So in fact, this tells you that I can decompose the quasi-particle currents into conserved currents associated with each Fermi surface manifold. And they're conserved if I only have infinitesimal momentum transfer to equilibrate the system, of course. So these actually are connected because you can't move them separately, and it's not visible in the bulk. But in fact, I won't go through the details, but when you go and project on the surface zone, you will always find these Fermi arcs which attach tangentially, which is a key point about Fermi arcs, which you don't really notice if you're dealing with the limit of this as a Fermi point. They attach like this, and they have a chirality associated with it, basically given by the normal to the facet, which I'm looking at, times the Fermi velocity. So these things have a direction which points from plus to minus. And so the role of the, just like the quantum, an integer quantum Hall, a 3D integer quantum Hall effect will give me a Fermi surface that extends from one side of the Brillouin zone to the other side. And from that, I can tell that's the quantum Hall contribution, which is a reciprocal vector. Here, the ambiguity of the reciprocal vector is resolved by looking at how I drew the Fermi. If I drew the Fermi surface, the Brillouin zone this way, there's no contribution from these. And if I draw the Brillouin zone this way, I pick up this tells me I didn't choose the nicest way to draw the Brillouin zone, and I have to pay a price that I have to adjust the dipole moment by that. And so the role of the wild points is precisely, again, contributing to the topological part of the formula, the part which is an integer number of reciprocal vectors. And in fact, the same principle holds in two dimensions. So if I look at the surface state, I don't want to go into this too much because I want to talk about the other topic. But if I look at two dimensions, say the facets of this system, they join at the edges of a crystal. And again, I have a Berry geometric formula, which is now the Berry phase for going around the Fermi surface, ambiguous modulo 2 pi, therefore ambiguous modulo integer. And I tell that integer by counting the number of right moving and left moving 1D Fermi points on the edges between the two facets. So again, at each point, there's a geometric part which comes from the dimension, and there's a topological part, which is a quantized topological part, which is seen at the boundaries of that in one dimension lower. And so it's absolutely incorrect that that Anton was going on about. Okay. So let me try and go on to, a second, quantum Hall effect. Come on, play.
So if you break inversion symmetry, then this plus minus bar points are not related by inversion.
There's no need to have inversion symmetry. Okay.
So in your example, there is inversion symmetry. So
there's broken time reversal symmetry, but there's no need to have inversion symmetry. I didn't mention inversion symmetry.
So you don't need that.
Of course not. There's nothing to do with inversion symmetry. Yeah. Okay. So before I got the quantum Hall effect. And I guess I was, you know, I learned something from Paul. I've been trying to understand Paul's stuff for many years and see how it relates to my own thoughts on this problem. And I'll give you my view on this, which I sort of gave last time. Let's go through and find some pictures. The basic problem is the fraction of quantum Hall effect fluids are quantum incompressible fluids, which, with due respect to Paul, are not related in any way to classical Euler equation fluids. An incompressible object, incompressibility naturally requires a geometry. Okay, it has to be a size of something that's kind of plugging together. And if I get a quantum solid, for example, I have a basic entity in a quantum solid is the correlation hole, which you make by removing electron, looking at the vacancy that's left behind. And basically, the stability of the quantum solid is determined by whether the potential due to removing the particle is enough to bind it if I put the particle back in again. That gives you a kind of Gruneisen law and things like that. Yeah. So the same principle work tells you about whether fractional quantum Hall state will form. It's again a collective effect. And instead, in the quantum Hall effect, it's a similar story, but we now have these incompressible objects which have a shape, just like the vacancy in the solid had a shape. The shape in the quantum Hall effect is the shape of the flux attachment. I'll come back to that. So basically, an electron sits in a hole, which is now not formed by a vacancy in a solid, but formed by creating a so-called flux attachment region around it, which is a certain number of orbitals, which it maintains to itself, like in a kind of Hubbard U fashion, like Mott physics. And then the other particles excluded from that region. And let's see if I got a picture for that here somewhere. I should have had a picture somewhere in this for it. The other particles are excluded from that region, and then, is it earlier on? Well, maybe not. So if I have a hole in the fluid and the particles are repelling each other, which is, of course, the important principle for getting these states, just as it is for the quantum solid, right? Then there's an attractive potential inside in the missing region, and that will have a certain number of levels in it. And in fact, the picture of the one-third Laughlin state is you have three levels inside this region, and you fill the first, and the other two are empty, and the other two, and you don't allow any other particles inside it. And these levels are essentially probably what Jane would interpret as his effective so-called lambda levels or something like that. These are, for example, for the two-fifths state, there are five levels inside. There's a droplet of five flux quanta, and there are five levels inside it, and you populate the lowest two according to the Pauli principle if they're spin polarized, etc. And if the Zeeman energy is small enough, I will populate them by putting them spin up and spin down in these levels. So I get the picture for the. So this is a physical picture of the incompressible composite boson of the quantum Hall effect. So this picture, the composite boson picture, describes this in the sense that the binding of the flux or the vortices to the particles provides a Berry phase that first of all cancels the Berry curvature that all vortices generally have when you move them around. Vortices behave like particles in a magnetic field. You move their center, they move them around the loop, they have a Berry curvature which will generally count the particle density inside the loop. The vortex is, because the vortices attached cancel that to make the thing effectively neutral. There's a selection rule, which is probably this one here somewhere, minus one to the. So if a filling factor of p particles in q orbitals, the odd denominator rule is this plus or minus one to the p, for this is bosons and that's for fermions. And the two numbers p and q have an individual life, that the effective fractional charge of the thing, the elementary fractional charge is e over q, and the charge q Q of the composite boson is P times E. And a fundamental selection rule on this, which I don't believe was noticed previously, is that there's a inversion symmetry of quantum Hall states, of the uniform, of the ideal quantum Hall states, dictates that the greatest common divisor of these things is either one or two. And for example, the Moore-Reed state is the case where it's two. And so and in fact, the nature of incompressible fluids shows up nicely in their excitation spectrum. They're different from the classical fluid because there is no excitations with momentum not equal to zero above in the clean system that are gapless. And momentum in the quantum Hall space also is equivalent to dipole moment at right angles to the momentum. So the ground state, the quantum Hall ground states have a property that they have a no dipole moment. And that, of course, is due to the inversion symmetry of the pure state. Okay. So inversions, so this is a much more powerful principle than just having a gap for charge, having a gap for dipole moment, a gap for things, any excitations that violate inversion symmetry is the most fundamental aspect of these incompressible states. And the case when you have 2 over 4, if you do these calculations in on a torus, you find there's a kind of naive Brillouin zone you write down, which is determined by the reduced form of P over Q with no common divisors. And the spectrum actually doesn't make sense in these cases where P is equal to, where the common divisor is 2. And instead, you find it makes perfect sense when you find 4 Brillouin zones of this thing. And for example, for the Moore-Reed case, if the number of particles, which again is one of these, you can think of it as a weak superfluid in analog, in 3, when the number of particles is odd, you get 3 copies of the 3 copies of the fermionic spectrum, and 1 copy. Oh, sorry, 3 copies of. Let's see which is which. You get one copy of the bosonic and 3 copies of the fermionic spectrum, and when the number of particles is even, you get 3 copies of the bosonic spectrum and 1 copy of the fermionic spectrum. And those are distinguished by what happens when I bring a pair of non-abelian quasi-particles together, quasi-particle quasi-hole together. They either fuse in the fermionic channel, which is this one, or the bosonic channel, which is the other one. And the crucial point about this gap is that these incompressible quantum fluids do not transmit pressure. They're fundamentally different from the classical incompressible fluid, which has a sound wave, sound velocity that went to infinity as the system becomes formally incompressible, and therefore transmits pressure instantaneously in a non-relativistic approximation. Here, there's no pressure transmitted from the exterior to the interior of the fluid. Pressure is transmitted around the boundary by the gapless edge modes, but it doesn't transmit between disconnected boundaries. Okay.
Oh, you didn't comment on this origin of the Virasoro algebra. So where do the higher L come from?
You'll derail me if I kind of. We can talk about that maybe a bit later. Okay. The Virasoro algebra is fundamentally related. Okay, the Virasoro algebra in the quantum Hall effect is fundamentally different from its application in the conformal field theory. There's actually no relation whatsoever directly between conformal field theory and the quantum Hall effect. It's a mirage. There's nothing conformal about anything in the quantum Hall effect. But what is the relation is that both conformal field theory and the quantum Hall effect fundamentally involve the Virasoro algebra and its representations. But they involve it in a very different way. In conformal field theory, you're not allowed to have a chiral state. You have to have C tilde. The chiral anomaly has to vanish. C and C bar have to be the same, because otherwise it's inconsistent. And of course, the structure of the Virasoro algebra is to do with energy, 2 copies of the energy towers. In this case, they're not 2 copies of anything. There's just a momentum direction. Energy is of no, there's no Lorentz invariance in this problem. Everything, but the Virasoro algebra is the algebra of momentum density, which is the algebra of diffeomorphisms of the edge, if I think of it, and that's how you couple the gravity. You distort the system, you have to reparameterize the edge. So the Virasoro algebra in the quantum Hall effect is chiral. It's got a chiral central charge, C tilde, and it's to do with momentum. And you can see from these gaps that momentum and momentum conservation in the uniform state and this gap for dipole moment is fundamental, because the Virasoro algebra is also can be viewed as the algebra of dipole excitations, the gapless dipole excitations at the edge. Because
I don't see this whole Virasoro algebra.
I guess we can talk about it later.
Okay.
Right?
But I can see also L2C, but I don't see the higher L.
We can talk.
Can we make a short, very short comment?
Yeah.
So quasi Hall states in Fresnel quantum Hall effect are singular vectors of Virasoro algebra.
Yeah, the Virasoro algebra is to do with momentum. It's not to do with energy, so it's not connected in any way to conformal field theory. It's just that the two things are similar, and because they have algebraic similarities, but not formal similarities. Okay. Okay. So everything is to do with quantum geometry, and the basic thing is this non-commutative algebra. So if we have the high field limit, or rather in the limit where the separation between Landau orbit states is much larger in energy than the energy scale associated with the interactions that give rise to the fractional Hall effect, then you have this separation into two degrees of freedom. And the guiding centers and the Landau orbits, I've got another one here. The classical coordinate electron splits into two things, which each individually don't commute. Once you've quantized the Landau orbits, you have a true quantum geometry problem which has no Schrodinger type representations. You cannot discuss it in terms of wave functions, because you cannot make a localized state, which is a delta function localized state, and maintain it. So everything follows from the pure part of the fractional part of the quantum Hall effect just follows from the structure of the guiding centers. So the degenerate flat levels are kind of occupied, quenching the Landau orbits, and then the residual problem is actually a smooth problem, a projected potential, which just involves the guiding centers which don't commute. Okay, and that's the entire problem. The fractional Hall effect, at least in this limit where the energy separation of Landau orbits and interactions is large, is entirely specified in terms of guiding centers. Therefore, anything that invokes anything that's not part of the guiding center problem is putting in baggage that's not fundamental to the problem. Okay.
Question?
Yeah.
If you allow Landau level mixing,
I'm not going to allow Landau level mixing.
But
I'm not
in. How the commutativity change?
Well, when you've got Landau level mixing, this is in the limit. We're going to analyze the problem in the limit that there is there's no entanglement between the 2 degrees of freedom. If you want to analyze a more complicated problem, you can do that, but we're going to say that the problem does not, the essential problem here, at least in Landau levels, is completely specified this way. So little fine minor detail issues about mixing them is perturbative, right? So basically this kind of problem gives rise, this repulsive interaction problem is like the inverse. If I look at the two-body problem, I can see that there's a kind of gap. Now it's an inverse potential problem in some sense. Two particles repel each other, and an incompressibility arises. Really, the Lofton state can be understood because you want to avoid putting any pair of particles in this higher energy state in the gap. Right. So this gap is what the gap here is the thing that really drives the whole picture. And okay. And so if I actually look at the Lofton state from this viewpoint, since I'm actually not allowed to discuss it in terms of wave function anymore, because I've decided that the wave functions do not describe quantum geometry states, we can convert the Lofton state into its correct Heisenberg form. Instead of Zi minus Zj, I've set up a set of operators, which in the usual case, we could put Rx plus Ry. And this would be a translation of what Laughlin wrote down into the Heisenberg formulation. Right? We have a These are the guiding center. This is the set of operators that move you in an onion ring of guiding center states centered in some point. And the basic point is that, that this choice Rx plus Ry is arbitrary, okay? At least from the point of view of the formal state. So the Lofen state is actually defined by a choice of a metric. The shape of the Lofen state is formulated in a set of levels that one would call z to the n, v to the n, e to the minus a half. Z star z in the Lofen language. But the Lofen state doesn't, the shape of this thing is a free parameter of the Lofen state. It's a metric, and the Lofen state has, if I choose a particular shape of this thing, the Lofen state is the one where the first orbital z occupied, the next two are always empty. So it defines the shape of the correlation problem. Naively, this is fixed by the lambda orbits, but lambda orbits don't fix the Lofen state, it's a response to interaction. So in fact, there are two completely separate geometries in this problem. One being the guiding center geometry, which is a geometry that emerges as a consequence of interactions, which is characterized by the geometry of the correlation hole, and the lambda orbit, which is characterized by the of the lambda orbit going around the galaxy.
Special geometry.
The entire fractional hole problem is the second one. The first one is a trivial part. Okay. So the quantum hole problem, the quantum hole problem decomposes into these two things in its most general case. Yeah. And
so the lambda orbits enslave.
No, the lambda orbits are
you can they're free to be
the guiding center correlation hole that so when Paul was talking about metrics and putting things on the surface of an egg, the Gauss-Bonnet theorem relates curvature of metrics to the Euler characteristic of the surface. But it actually doesn't tell you which metric to use for the guiding centers.
Can you put them on?
Sorry.
So it doesn't have the clip. I'm sorry about that.
We'll find out. Just continue.
It's okay. Sorry about that.
Sure, it's around somewhere. Okay, so the 2 degrees of freedom are just different, right? Now, of course, the shape of the correlation, the shape of the effective potential that the guiding center sees involves a combination of the Coulomb potential and the form factors of the orbits. But fundamentally, unless you have a phonon passing through, the lambda orbit shape doesn't change. But the shape of this metric, the guiding center metric, adjusts itself to minimize the correlation energy of the problem. is a flexible metric. So to understand what a metric isn't something abstract. A metric has a meaning. A metric is only defined by physics. Without, you can mathematically define metrics and all what you can, but there's always a physical definition which gives rise to a metric. In the vacuum, the Minkowski vacuum, it's how long light travels. It's light. The spatial part is distance that light travels at equal times, etc. Right, and that's note that. And when the usual case where the metric comes down to condensed matter is the Minkowski metric affects condensed matter because the core regions of atoms are spherical. So on the atomic scale, condensed matter knows about the metric of the vacuum because inside the deep regions of the atom, if things are moving very fast, you pick up the kind of Lorentz invariant metric. But in the quantum field, in magnetic fields which are not too high, where the magnetic length is much larger than the magnetic area is much larger than the unit cell of any atomic structure on the surface, the quantum Hall problem has no becomes an effective continuum. It has no knowledge whatsoever of the metric of the vacuum. Okay. So if we put the thing on the surface of an egg, the only way it knows about things, there are two things. There's the two geometrical things are the shape of the Coulomb potential near the short distance form of the Coulomb potential, which defines the extra potentials, which are little circles, right? Another set of little circles are the little circles that Lambda orbits. If I tilt the magnetic field away from the normal to the surface, and the surface is not infinitely bound, so the surface state tilts a little bit, even if I had a rotational invariance before I tilted the field, I would have a different shape for the Lambda orbit shape and the Coulomb potential shape.
Are they entangled? I mean, it seems like you have 2 degrees of freedom.
They're not entangled in the high field. The high field limit is really the unentangled.
High field meaning you don't mix Lambda levels.
Yeah, it's not really high field because high field would actually, you know, eventually exceed the magnetic length would shrink and become less than atomic size.
Yeah.
It's actually the limit in which the interaction is weak compared to the splitting of the Lambda levels. That's the true meaning of high field. Field is going to fix. In that limit, the 2 degrees of freedom, because it become energetically separated, become unentangled.
So are you saying the quantum Hall is a single particle problem, just too metric for these two things?
It's not a single particle problem. But
that's all you care about, right? Just these two metrics.
It's not all I can compare about, because the topological parts are there. So metrics of what? Okay, so... So the... let's just go through the. So the two things, the interesting things are. So the geometry is there that the guiding center metric can adjust itself. So a guiding center metric in a uniform system will adjust itself to minimize the correlation energy of the problem. But now if I put a uniform system with a substrate potential on top of it, the guiding center adjusts itself to minimize a combination of the potential and the correlation energy. And it can do that by deforming locally. So if I have a U-shaped valley and I put my droplet, my composite boson, little composite in there, it'll actually elongate to kind of be squeezed by the gradient of the electric field will squeeze it. So in fact, if I'm near the edge of a system, the shape of the hole might be like so, but in this case it elongates in that direction. You can see there's a kind of U-shaped valley there, which is so there's a gradient of the electric field, which means that there's a gradient of the flow velocity of this system, and the geometry elongates on the direction of the flow. So the nice thing about that is that one of the fundamental topological parts of the geometry is what Chagan and Tony Z found, that there is the relation that if you that Gaussian curvature is quantized. I integrate the Gaussian curvature on a closed manifold. It fits in. Gaussian curvature can only flow. It's got a conservation law. So just as the first part of the quantum Hall relation relates to magnetic flux, which can also only move by a flow process by the Faraday law, it actually has a second part which couples to Gaussian curvature. So the actual, and there are two separate degrees of freedom, but there can be a Gaussian curvature of the Lambda orbit metric, which might be relevant in the case where surface acoustic wave goes through the integer Hall effect, for example. But that's not going to generally move up. So the Gaussian curvature, which is going to come about through response to the potential, is the Gaussian curvature of the guiding centers, which is this. So if I look at this thing, you'll find that there's a net Gaussian curvature here. So the coupling of the charge, the composite boson object, which is this charge P object, is coupled to the combination of PEV over H bar minus S times the Gaussian curvature of the guiding centers. So the actual If I look at the formula that Shogan found, of course, it split the which they interpreted as a shift. It's actually a sum of two terms. The shift is a sum of there's a trivial spin, a half, three halves, five halves associated with the lambda orbits, and there is another spin, which is the spin of the composite boson, and that could be evaluated very easily by looking at for example, the Lofton state, one third, I put 100 in the sort of three orbitals. That would be m momentum, a half, three halves, five halves, which adds up to a total of a half. But if I put a third in, it would be three halves. I have to regularize the system by subtracting the background. So just as you remove the background to get the neutral boson to cancel Bohm-Mahoronoff, you have to cancel out the trivial part, which just depends on the filling factor, and what's left behind tells you you find that the composite boson is a neutral object, Bose exchange statistics, and it carries a residual spin, which is minus one in the case of the Lofton state at one third. The Lofton state at one half has minus a half and is the most quantum of all the smallest value a spin can have is a half, plus, and it's a signed spin, plus or minus a half. And it's, again, these have a feature that it's odd under particle hole transformations. So if I look at the full structure of the thing, we will have the filling factor, the full set of topological quantum numbers of a generic quantum Hall state, but the filling factor defined by these two numbers. Then there's the guiding center spin, and there would also be a lambda orbit spin, so I have more than one thing. And there's a geometric part, which is a metric, two metrics. And finally, there is an interesting part, which is a gravitational anomaly, which is the C tilde, and splits into C tilde minus mu for the guiding centers and mu. So the decomposition into things, again, there's a gravitation. The gravitational anomaly is if the edge of the system is in a non-inertial frame, there's a four acceleration parallel to the edge, I get an energy flow from the inside to the edge. Similarly, if I have an electric field parallel to the edge, I get a charge flow. So, and the chiral at the gravitational anomaly splits nicely, that all the quantity C tilde minus mu is what comes out of the guiding center part of the problem. And you'll notice that for the integer Hall effect, on filled lambda levels, C tilde is equal to mu as fixed just by the churn number of the bands. When you go to the interacting system, you lose this relation that couples. You lose the notion of churn number of the single particle states, the band, and the C. But so you can see that this quantity C tilde minus U is both completely insensitive to any amount of filled bands, and it's also odd on the particle Hall transformations within the lambda level. So this is the content of the things, and so what Paul showed us, I guess, with Paul's formulas are kind of brought into this decomposed form, you'll see that this is the fractional part of the gravitational anomaly is indeed not C tilde is not one, but it's C tilde was one for the quantum for the one third state, but for the one third state, C tilde minus mu is going to be is two thirds, right? One third and two thirds. In fact, when we did a Casimir momentum calculation I described the last time I came here, we were initially surprised to find that 1/36 rather than 1/22 like seven figure accuracy for the numerics, other than 1/24 for things. And then, of course, we realized that we were, of course, doing orbital entanglement cuts, which are completely a guiding center calculation. And so, and when you look at the difference, you see you pick up orbital entanglement gives you a contribution C to the minus U to the estimate. So anyway, the thing about the nice thing then is that we see the geometry is actually has a key role to play, at least in understanding the compressibility of the fractional orbit. So this set of numbers describes the bulk fluid. It doesn't describe the topological quantum field theory's detailed structure of the topological order within the fluid. But from the level of the fluid itself, the fluid properties themselves define three topological and in fact, or one pair of geometrical quantities, two metrics. And I guess I probably ran out of time. anything else I can show in that 1 minute? Okay. I guess this is a comment about the Virasoro algebra, but this is my view of the connection with these things. Let's see if the previous slide says that. Basically, there are two invoked regions of places where the conformal field theory is sort of invoked, and it's all on a kind of hand-waving level. It's empirical observation that the Lofton state looks like a conformal block of conformal field theory. And there's this kind of tension between a Euclideanized form in the interior for wave functions and the edge state. But the edge states are certainly not conformally invariant because there's no Lorentz invariant, no universal speed, so no angles that are preserved by anything. And the inside part also, we see now that actually is more like general relativity than special relativity. The metric is actually a degree of freedom that can change. So the conformal field theory will only allow expansions and contractions of the metric, conformal transformations. But the incompressibility doesn't actually allow directly conformal transformations. It only allows the shape change part. Now, the interesting thing, which I think is a connection to Paul's form of this stuff, is that we see that the effective L of, before the algebra of the guiding center was formulated in terms of L effective, which is basically this quantity. Is 1 over L squared, LB squared. So in fact, we see that L squared, because of this correction from Gaussian curvature, goes to L squared over 1 plus S Gaussian curvature times LB squared, which is LB squared minus S AB A L to the 4th. And so the quantum algebra of the guiding center self-consistently corrects itself in this state because the Gaussian curvature feeds back changing. It's not just the magnetic field. It feeds back, and it feeds back proportionally with S, and that will give you these, this will give you these extra terms, and then these are the terms I think that Paul is looking at in his form. But so the, right, so interestingly, it's a kind of, although you start with the kind of quantization condition with this uniform field, you see the contributions that to the gradients of the metric to find the effective field. So anything else on this? Yeah, there was a picture. I was looking for. Okay.
So I think we should
move on. Yeah.
Okay. So can we thank this speaker again? Just speaker.
So we understand it's a here you have two universal numbers, nu and c q. So nu certainly can be calculated using current correlation function. I wonder whether c q can be seen, you say, in an energy correlation function or energy density current correlation function or something. But
It would presumably be the metric correlation function, which I could give you the metric for the fractional Hall effect. There's an algebra which is RA. If I look at the generators of error preserving linear deformations, they are like GL 2R for algebra. Kind of like the Lorentz group, right? Not about algebra. So there's actually two copies of this algebra, one for the guiding centers and one for the and the orbits. And if you want to make it rotation invariant, you have to introduce a metric and contract it with it. But this thing is the
So basically, the metric itself is essentially the expectation value of this object, which gives you the quadratic, the second moment of the first case, the guiding center. This has to be regularized. You have to subtract the background from this guiding center. But when you do that, you can have a local operator written in terms of the guiding center fields, which describes which is the shape of the correlations at that point. So I would guess that, and the expectation value of that is it's a signed object, so it actually is the topological spin times the metric. And so it may well be the correlation functions of this. When you semi-classically quantize the metric, again, the components of the metric don't commute. This algebra, the chasm of this algebra is essentially the determinant. So the quantum fluctuations of the metric are fluctuations at a fixed area. And those actually imprinted in the state by the q to the fourth thing of Gerbinen structure factor, long wavelength structure factor that Gerbinen and Platzman found, are just like the Debye-Waller factors in quantum solid. They're also the quantum fluctuations of the gapped gravitational which we saw in this kind of, which is above the gap of the
And we have time for one quick question.
Hi, that's a question. So at the beginning, you mentioned there's the translation and inversion symmetry is important. So
this is wild notes.
What happened in the presence of disorder, you break both symmetries. So starting from this non-commutative geometry and at a repulsive interaction, do you expect emergent translational symmetry or not?
Yeah, so in the quantum Hall effect, of course, it's a topological state, so it doesn't require either translation or inversion symmetry, but the properties of the uniform, the underlying fluid, the kind of clean version which you thought it has.
Yeah, but
so basically it's resistant to breaking of the, because the inversion symmetry is a gap for making dipole moments. Of course, when I actually put some translational breaking in, I get Gaussian curvature around, so I actually do have long wavelength dipole moment coming in, but still it's resistant to dipole moments. So it doesn't require, of course, strict translational inversion symmetry, not fully. It's not a symmetry protected state that requires inversion symmetry. And
at the beginning, if we don't start from this translational invariant case.
So fluid can be understood from this translation, this underlying fluid. The kind of ideal fluid is translation and inversion symmetry. And it's resistant to, because of its gap, it's adiabatically resistant to small amounts of disorder.
All right. So thank you. And let's thank the speaker again.